You are listening to Uncanny Landscapes, Excursions into the Otherwise, with Justin Hopper.
I wanted to allow myself to say that my folk music is the music that makes up me. And my traditions are what I are everything that's gone into me. And so it's like just thinking about us as our own. We are our own like worlds and universes, and everybody's got all these different experiences. And so that kind of empowered me, just being able to think like that, that I do have something to say.
Welcome to Uncanny Landscapes, a series of conversations around and excursions into landscapes of the otherwise. Each episode features an interview with a landscape practitioner, someone whose work is rooted in the strange ways we today experience our surroundings. I am your host, Justin Hopper, and you've just heard today's guest, Laura Connell, discussing the way she approaches folk music in her compositions and recordings. More from Laura very soon. The music you hear now is The Earth Under the Sea from one of Laura's latest releases, Sea Lore, available through her Brawl Records Bandcamp page. Please take a moment to subscribe to Uncanny Landscapes on Substack. It's free and includes the podcast as well as my newsletters of related topics and works in progress. Or like and subscribe on your own podcast platform. But whatever you do, tell a friend about Uncanny Landscapes, maybe a few. It's all available through uncannylandscapes.substack.com. Laura Connell is a composer, performer, and recording artist whose music straddles the worlds of folk, experimental, chamber, early, and medieval music, using a variety of instruments, primarily recorder and violin. Her performances employ techniques such as playing multiple recorders at once, overbowing the violin, and using electronic effects, often on semi-improvised music. Her albums such as Quick Sparrows Over the Black Earth and Antiphony of the Trees are beloved by experimental, classical, and folk audiences alike. Laura's work is consistently inspired by East Anglia, the oft-forgotten eastern corner of England around Norfolk and Suffolk, where she was born, raised, and lives today. Laura's music has been very important to me over the past 10 years, since I too moved to East Anglia. It reveals a way of relating to place through music that tells stories about the landscape, not through words or pictures, but the rhythms of flight and stasis, the long seasons and short fauna lives that make the countryside so deeply, darkly engaging. I hope this interview opens up a way of listening to her work, and perhaps introduces Laura as a person as well, because while her artistry is as precise as it is complex, with all the seriousness that implies, Laura herself is disarmingly funny and joyful, constantly looking for the magical over the mundane. Here she is now, talking about her childhood in the fields of East Anglia, Laura Connell.
I am very East Anglian, so I was born in Norwich and grew up from when I was 0 to 11. I lived in this village called Thirlton. And it's on the edge of the Broads and the marshes, and it's in South Norfolk. And we lived right at the edge of the village down a lane, and we were like the last house. And then it turned from lane called Sandy Lane because it was very sandy. It turned from sort of sand into water meadows. So I spent like a lot of my childhood just outside in the water meadows and making bows and arrows, you know, that sort of thing. And like the village school was, you could either walk through the village, or the way that our mum took me and my sister was what we called across the pigs. So there's this field of pigs with a footpath along, again, like skirting around the village. So we didn't really have to talk to anyone apart from the animals and the birds and stuff. So we used to walk to school that way, and then sometimes we'd come back and they'd be taking the cows in, so then the road would be closed and we'd have to wait for all the cows to go past. And so it was very, very rural.
Could you just describe to me, when you're talking about water meadows, can you tell me what you mean and what that looks like?
Yeah, so I never thought of a water meadow, as I didn't really know what that was because they called it Water Meadow Lane after we moved. But before that, it was just the back lane, and it's just big marshy fields that just are quite low lying. And one of the great things about them, there are two main fields that are always in my memory. Well, sort of four to each side. And we used to get giant puffballs there, you know, like these huge mushrooms that you can cook. We used to go in the right weather, the right environment, the right everything had just aligned. You could find these enormous puffballs that were like the size of footballs, these big white mushrooms, and then take them home, and then our dad would cook them for breakfast. So it was like very, I don't know, very sort of watery. Don't know. I mean, I guess water meadows, that's why they called it that. But they were just fields, like boggy fields.
I mean, what you've just described, walking to school across the fields, picking these giant mushrooms and cooking them for breakfast, I mean, that can't be actually that different from the way someone as a child would have lived 100 years before you, or, you know, or the way even like someone like John Clare describes their kind of upbringing.
Yeah, I think that's what's really strange, actually, is that this was in the 80s, you know, 80s and early 90s. And it's really weird to me that actually, on the one hand, I don't know, technology and the world and everything, but it's like industrialization hadn't really hit the village even then. You know, it's a marsh village. I mean, people drove in to Norwich to work, and there were quite a lot of people that worked in a local. Well, it was called like a mental health hospital or a mental hospital, which is terrible. But loads of people worked there, and loads of people worked in Norwich. And so it was kind of like, on the one hand, this really, really ancient kind of way of living. But also, my parents were antique dealers, so everything was old. Everything was like, everything had a story and a history. And I wasn't like consciously thinking, oh, this is so whimsical and lovely, and this is really good material for inspiration when I'm 45 or whatever. You know, I was just like, we were just there. We were just living our lives. But yeah, I mean, there were so many things that haven't changed.
It's an upbringing that no one else can sort of necessarily relate to, where, like you said, where everything has a story and there's a value placed on it. Can it actually, can you just riff on that for a second? I mean, what is that
Yeah.
kind of childhood like?
What is that childhood?
What
It's
are
just
you?
who even are you? What year is this? Yeah, it's really weird, actually. So my dad worked for British Telecom until he was 36, and he gave his notice in. He'd always been like sort of trading on the side, you know. He'd always, since he was really little growing up in Norwich, he came from quite a big family in a tiny house, not much money. And they used to sort of, I don't know, forage is the right word, but they used to find bottles and sell them, you know. And so he'd always been kind of like researching and finding things on the side. But anyway, he gave up his job. He like handed in his notice up for his 36th birthday, and then went full time as a self-employed antique dealer. So I guess I was about 8, 7, something like that. So yeah, and he just used to go off and fill his van up, you know. So sometimes he'd go off and fill his van up, and sometimes he'd come back and people would come and fill their vans up, and we'd get all these dealers that would turn up at the house at like 5 o'clock in the morning. It was really bizarre. There was one really regular dealer from London who would come and buy loads of stuff from my dad is like a he's like a dealer's dealer, so he does sell to actual people, and he has, you know, to the public and everything. But really, his favorite thing is finding stuff and selling it to other people who are then going to maybe do the work and then sell it on. But he just loves all the stories. So yeah, I don't know. It's
That
I.
is, I mean, but it is quite a like you alluded to earlier and just now, it's quite a narrative-driven profession, I imagine.
Yeah,
It's like a
completely. It's all
folklorist.
stories. Yeah, absolutely. And weirdly, he's just been invited to do a talk on a folklore podcast, because I introduced him to TikTok recently, and he did a piece about a witch bottle, his favorite witch bottle, not just he has several, and I like it's been sitting in our house in my parents' house for like 20 years, and he'd never told me that story. I never knew that you put the hair, the urine and hair of a witch, and then smash it or burn it on the fire. And then I was just like, why haven't you told me this? But everything is a story, and when you get a bunch of antique dealers together, like everything is, oh my God. And then did you see that? And it's all about history, and it's all about stories and where they bought it and who they sold it to and things that come round again. Like, I'm sure I bought that table 10 years ago, and all this stuff. And so basically he and my mum were just sort of trading, buying and selling, and built quite big barns, not barns, sheds. Really, it wasn't that clever. It was like we lived in a two up, two down cottage on the edge of the village, and they got like three massive sheds and filled them up with stuff. And I remember being so excited because they put a concrete base down for one of them, and it was ideal for roller skating. So that's what I basically spent my time before it got filled up, because like I said, it was like down a really sandy lane, so you
Yeah,
couldn't
yeah.
get it all in your wheels of your roller skates. So it's very 80s, isn't it? I started playing the recorder at school, and because of the antique dealer parents, they actually got me like a second hand or fifth hand wooden recorder, so it immediately felt special. So everyone was playing on, your plastic our Lawson Yamaha recorders, and I had this kind of, it wasn't necessarily that in tune, but it was, I don't know if it was particularly a good make or anything. I don't think it wasn't, but it felt really special. And so much of the music that I started to play was, well, no, basically we did record a lesson group, primary school recorder group thing, and I just really loved it. And I used to, I think we didn't have a telly at the time, and I used to just, or maybe we, anyway, it, we had one variously on and off, and so I would just like hear things on the radio or on the telly when we had one, and just I just could play all the tunes from memory. I didn't think that was particularly weird or special. I just would hear something and then play it. No, recorder was my first instrument. I'd sang like in the local, I can't, what was it? There was like a funny youth choir in the village, but and Sunday school from atheist parents. So they used to send us to Sunday school for a lie-in,
Oh, I love it.
and this funny lady from next door, who everybody called Auntie Margaret, who was the worst musician in the world, would play the piano like blah, 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 just like bashing her hands all over in the chapel, and it was freezing and dark and damp. But we all just kind of had to go there and sing stuff. And lots of people did things, like there was a man who actually is, we still see once a year at the local country fair. He was a, really loved folk singing. He's from Newcastle or somewhere like that. So he had like a really amazing tradition, a really brilliant voice. And you don't really kind of take it in at the time, but I just remember learning songs by ear, in a group of sort of raggle taggle local children, So yeah, so recorder, and then my mum got us piano lessons with the local travelling piano teacher from the next village. He drove around and taught everybody. He would always, go to everyone's house, and we had a great piano from that my dad had got, like, from an antiques fair.
Well, and again, you're alluding to this idea that the object itself isn't quite as important as its antiquity and its narrative, and it
That's
you know.
interesting, actually, because I've never really, I hadn't thought about it as going that early back, but I've never, partly because of not having money, not coming from money and
Right.
all that, not there was never any spare money. So even until the third year of my undergraduate degree, which I did in music performance, specializing in recorder, till the beginning of the third year, I didn't have a really good instrument. I was still playing quite a lot of stuff on plastic instruments
Right,
at music college in London, which is crazy. And there are people whose parents are carrying their violins for them, and just people remortgaging houses to get an instrument. And I was literally just didn't. I was just playing the music. The music and the sound was the important thing. I would have, I probably would have liked to have something earlier, but I didn't really know that you were supposed to have all the really good instruments.
Well, but really good is a completely.
I know, I know. That
I
doesn't
mean.
make any sense because it's and it's actually stood me in good stead because I did a lot of early music, like Baroque and Renaissance music. And there were times when I knew people who wanted to play certain repertoire, but they were like, well, we can't do that because we don't have the correct this recorder or that
It's.
harpsichord. And so everyone was just going, oh, no, all the reasons you can't do things. And I was just like, just give us a recorder. Just give me a piano. It doesn't matter. Like, you can make music out of whatever you've got. It doesn't matter. So I think that probably instilled that quite early, that where it was from and how much it was not the important thing. Yeah, so I started piano lessons with the traveling piano teacher, and I really hated it, and I didn't practice, and I just didn't like it. I didn't like the sound. It just didn't. I think a lot of people start playing the piano, and it made no sense to me. Not like I could see how the notes were laid out, but I just found it really boring. And I felt like I wasn't supposed to think that because, it's a piano and pianos are this and that. But anyway, so I said, because I was obviously quite into music and not very, I didn't really hide, wasn't good at hiding my feelings, I don't think. So my piano teacher said, you're not getting on that well with the piano. I also play the recorder and do Baroque music. Would you like to have lessons in that instead? And so then he started teaching me, and then I kind of got to a certain point where he was like, actually, I can't take you any further. You need to go to the next person. And then luckily, in the town down the road, there were two professional early music performers. One of them was a professor of music at Trinity College of Music in London, and him and his wife both played in this group called Musica Antica of London, who used to, they were like really big and important on sort of research and early music. And so
Can you just remind those of us who aren't so knowledgeable about these things what you mean when you say early music? And also tell me, because I've never quite understood,
yeah, so early
is early
music,
music and Renaissance and Baroque music, are those the same thing, or
they're
is
the same thing. So
it?
early music, so when people talk about classical music, they that kind of covers everything that is like a classical instrumentation. But really, classical music happens after Baroque music. So if you go back, let's go all the way back. So we've got medieval. We'll start from medieval. Medieval, Renaissance, Baroque, and then classical, Romantic, and then sort of modernist, high modernism. Blah, blah, blah. We don't need to worry about that. But yeah, when I'm talking about early music, I'm really talking about stuff from the kind of 10th to the 18th century,
Oh,
or
right.
12th to the
Okay.
18th century. So it's like 600 years of transitioning from like really modal, like plain chant, like Hildegard von Bingen, unaccompanied singing and plain chant and stuff like that, Gregorian chant. And then you're going into Renaissance, where things became a bit more polyphonic. So parts were written that intertwined, so everything wasn't just a tune. So if you think about the really early stuff as being more like traditional folk music, where there's like one melody or one tune, and then it just kind of starts to sort of sprout different layers. And then like with Baroque music, you just got much more organized and much more complex, sort of mathematically complex in a different way. But anyway, I mean, that's very sort of a simple way of thinking of it. But it's just going from monophonic, basically, to polyphonic. So monophonic
Okay.
is a single line, or like a dance. If you imagine like medieval music as being, I always think of it like there's some really early Italian dances. It's like a collection of 12 tunes that are really, really, really early, and they're kind of like hopping dances. So like there's where folk music and what we call classical music just were the same thing.
Right, I
There are people
see.
learning by memory because it wasn't notated necessarily, or if it was, people, not everyone could read it, you know. So a lot of stuff by ear, and then it gradually kind of carried on. It's about music from the people being taken into courts and being formalized and written down. So that's where it goes from folk music into
Right.
formal court music. So that's a really big thing because, you know, you've got peasants and you've got non-peasants.
Right.
And that's basically where it all comes from. And as
And
soon as what you do is you steal the good tunes from the peasants
yeah.
and then you have it in the court, and that makes it better. So it's like having, I can play a tune in a pub,
Yeah.
but I could play some Vivaldi in a pub, which I used to do like in Norwich. And that's like not a normal thing to do, is to go and play a recorded concerto or whatever, or a bit of one in a pub while everyone's drinking as part of a night of people doing indie and whatever music. But that's going to be taken more seriously by a certain set of people if you do it in a concert hall or an assembly house or a church. And that's all it is. That's the thing that kind of, it's like the hierarchy. And then what's happened is that everybody's made their rules. So like the classical people have made all of their rules about etiquette and how you're supposed to enjoy classical music and how you're supposed to sit. And concerts didn't used to exist before, like they just didn't exist in the same way that we know them. No, people didn't used to go and sit in a big hall. It would be like chamber or pub, or you know, just it just isn't. It's just become very, very formalized and very separate and segregated.
Do you feel like you're drawing on an inspiration from that point where those two things existed more fluidly?
Yeah, so I've always been really interested in, I really love music from the Baroque era and the Renaissance. You know, like I love Monteverdi. He was like avant-garde, you know, like really pushing the limits and making the most beautiful, amazing music. And I really love Baroque stuff because as a recorder player, that's like when it was a virtuoso solo instrument. The flute wasn't important that, you know, as important then. So flutes and recorders, they're both wooden and they both had similar kind of volume. But in terms of classical stuff, the silver flute, you know, development, instrumental development meant that recorders got chucked out of the orchestra and became like nothing until they were revived in the early 1900s and then taken into schools and all that kind of stuff. But for before that, they were like really important. My dad has always been really into traditional unaccompanied singing, so he had lots of records of that. My mum has always been into quite Baroque music, so like countertenors. So I'd be listening to like Purcell and Handel and like, you know, the sort of big English and German Baroque composers. So that along, so it weirdly, I've had the traditional and the early, the sort of early Baroque and Renaissance stuff in my ears, you know, from a young age. heard some people playing the fiddle, and on some of these records that my dad was playing, there was Dave Swarbrick, and obviously growing up with listening to loads of Steel Ice Band and Pentangle and all of those people, the sort of big English folk revival electronic-y people, electronic-y, electric, you know what I mean? Yeah, and I just really love the fiddle, and so I got myself a fiddle at an antiques market. There's a bit of a theme here, and it was
And
£14.
let me just stop you and ask, when you say fiddle, is it different from saying violin in your
No,
case?
so that's my
Okay.
tomato tomato.
Oh,
No,
it is.
it's
Okay.
a potato potato, maybe isn't one. I don't know. Yeah, so a fiddle is the exact same instrument as a violin. It's just how you play it and what you play on it. So yeah, so I'm a self-taught fiddle player. So I got this fiddle, and then I started learning tunes by ear off these records. So I had to keep putting them back, the needle back to to the different groove. So yeah, so when I was 16, I started playing the fiddle, and I just used yeah, I just learnt loads. And then when I could drive, I would go to the folk sessions around East Anglia and just sit and learn the tunes. And yeah.
So there was never a time where you were playing classical violin music.
No, God, no, can't do that at all. I mean, I can pretend. I can do some of it. I can do it. I can play more Baroque stuff. So then I would, because obviously I can read music and play stuff and add all the sort of ornamentation techniques and stuff like that and knowledge from doing the recorder repertoire. A lot of it is intermingled, and a lot of Baroque music is written for a treble instrument. So a violin or a recorder or an oboe or a flute. So they're sort of interchangeable.
So at some point, like we said, you sort of changed from that much more strict, isn't the right word, but much more traditional
Yeah,
folk style playing, and which is obviously still quite deeply, a deep root of what you're doing, but still you that began to change maybe 10, 11 years ago.
so in 2001, so I did my undergrad in recorded playing, so I did contemporary and early music with my sort of specialisms, and then, but I didn't get on that well with it, and I just. So then I went to the UEA in Norwich, the University of East Anglia, to the music department, which doesn't exist now. But I did a master's in performance there, and there was only myself and one other person on our course, and so there was no taught element at all. But there was an electro acoustic and sonic arts master's and PhD, and there were loads of people doing that. So I used to just go to that. So I went to their seminars and lectures and performances, and then gradually became more interested in that kind of improvising and doing different stuff. So I was still it's like I was just trying to. I had this idea in my head that I wanted to be a musician and a recorder player, but I didn't know what that was or what it meant. And as I went on and on further into it, I realized I didn't want to be playing other people's music all the time. And but I never knew, and I never was told or suggested that I could write my own music, because it's like when you're studying, you have to choose composition or performance. You're not just a musician. And so I really struggled with that and found it really very restrictive. Yeah, so I moved out of London 2001. 2003, I finished my master's, and while I was doing that, I started a group called Horses Brawl, which was a trio, and that was really bringing early music. I know, so I feel so funny saying early all the time now, but now that you kind of know, it's sort of like early dance stuff, like Baroque early dance. Yeah, early jungle, jumbos, you know. I
I
was
was
really
just gonna
bringing all
say
of the early jungle
early
into
dance music, like a guy called Gerald.
yeah. That's bringing all the early hits in by Guillaume de Machaut, you know, the French medieval poet and composer, and Pretorius, all the people. Anyway, I was bringing those things. So the point of Horses Brawl was to sort of marry up and recompose really traditional folk music from the UK and Europe and sort of Scandinavian stuff and Polish and Hungarian, all these amazing kind of interesting tunes that were all a bit kind of just a lot more energy than traditional English stuff that I'd sort of grown up with. So it was like combining those things. And then, yeah, so I did that for like 9 years, and it had a couple of different sort of lineups, I suppose. Yeah, we slightly fell out with somebody, you know, that kind of thing. But just, you know, you're not practicing enough. Okay, bye. That sort of thing. It wasn't really that dramatic. Yeah, so we did loads of performing and loads of gigs, and it was that weird thing of like being on, I don't know, the kind of classical, being a weird, here's our weird thing we're putting on at this arts festival, this classical music festival, and here's our kind of folky thing we're putting on at our early music festival, and never really having a place. And then I decided just to lean into it. You know, the place is the place in between, the bits I'm interested in, the notes in between the two notes.
I don't want to sound like I'm trying to shoehorn my sort of themes into everything, but I
Yeah, go
do
on.
always think that this part of the country is the place in between, is the place that
Well, it
isn't
is, isn't it?
any of the other places, and that's what
It's,
it is.
yeah, and well, people in the north think we're the south, and people in the south don't care.
That's exactly it, isn't it? That's
I'm
exactly
just
it.
thinking, what do they think? They don't care because we're not in the north or the
They don't know
south.
it's there.
No.
People 50 miles away don't seem to know we're
No,
here.
and I always think, you know, like if you look at the border of Wales and the size of Wales, if you put East Anglia and you put a border, we're like our own country in the same way, like land mass, obviously not culturally, well, kind of culturally as well. But, you know, it's actually just if you think about the shape of it, it's just sort of blows my mind, really, that there's this whole country over there, and Cornwall is like a whole country, and East Anglia is a whole, you know, and also because we're all of our history is so connected to, you know, from sort of across the sea. It's so connected that way that we're much closer to France and Holland and Spain and all those places than we are to like anywhere on the other side of our country.
Can you talk for a minute about that? So, can you just tell us where we're talking about when we talk about East Anglia, and also you mentioned earlier the sort of the marshes and the broads, Norfolk Broads, and maybe you can just describe this strange kind of neither land nor
Yeah.
sea existence that we have in the East.
Yeah, so East Anglia is like this, if you look at the whole shape of Britain or the British Isles, it's this, there's a quite a straight line down the right hand side, and then there's this kind of almost the bottom of a square, which is called the Wash, where which is, and then we've got this big kind of big hummock that comes out, a big round thing that comes out. And so the east coast, I mean, you can have the north of the east coast, which is like Holt and Blakeney and all of those places, and then as you come round and round and round, you get the most easterly point in England, which is in just off the coast at Pake, where Pakefield meets Lowestoft. And it's like the most, I mean, I'm like 10 miles from the most easterly point in England. And it's just this kind of, I don't know, the landscape here is really, you know, people just think it's flat. It's not just flat. It's like giant causeways. There's so much underneath the surface, and there's so much like amazing sort of varied, I can't really explain, but like the tundra is really, really interesting, I think. And yeah, where I grew up, I mean, me and my sister, like, we're just like, we grew up on the Norfolk Broads, but we never went on the Norfolk Broads. So we were always like, what is everyone to, I mean, literally the next village, there's a broad where we grew up, but we never was part because it's only become like the Broad National Park in the last 10 or 15 years.
We're talking about an area that's somewhat marshy, that's water meadows and canal-like creature,
Yeah, and
and
but it's really sandy as well in some places because
yeah.
it's like the coast has moved so much. So there's this amazing church on a cliff at Cove Hythe, which again, it's not that far from where I'm sitting right now. Maybe I want to say maybe 12 miles away, and the water is eroding the cliff. I can't remember if it's 1 meter a year or 5 meters or something ridiculous. And there's a church built inside a ruined church, and the road next to it just goes and then it drops into the sea. I mean, it's like a massive cliff. Obviously, you can't drive along it. You can only get to a certain point, but it's going to just fall in. And that's what happened to like the whole city of Dunwich as well. You know, it all is in the sea. That's where it is. It's
So
all just fallen in.
we're talking about this really, this is why I think of it as you agreed, as this in-between space, because it's kind of, it's kind of tentative, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of, there are bits of it that have been washed into the ocean. There used to be obviously we're talking tens of thousands of years ago, but there was a land bridge to
Yeah, so
the
Doggerland. I mean,
Netherlands.
I'm completely obsessed with that at the moment. I've just been, you know, there was this deer antler harpoon, or a harpoon made out of a deer antler that was found in, was dug up by some, or trawled up by some Cromer fishermen in 1939 or 31. Can't quite remember. I read it the other day, but and it, you know, like a really a hand carved harpoon for fishing in this in-between space. I mean, maybe this is why we feel like this. There's just this entire, and again, it's the space between things. It's like there's this entire life of all these people that happened in the like before the last major climate change, you know, and all there was a big icy mass. And as it gradually melted, people were able to use, well, they were able to fish like through the ice, but also as it became sort of drier and more usable, people would come from the mainland from here and from like sort of west straight across like Netherlands, I suppose. And they'd come from there, and the people would come across in the summer, and their whole families and tribes and whoever would come across, and they would be foraging on that land. I'm completely obsessed with that at the moment. I've just written a piece called The Earth Under the Sea. And it's, I'm just like, all I can think about is this, like, I might be placing myself in this slightly, but like a girl growing up in a marshy place or in a,
Yeah.
you know, whittling things and making things and practicing on wood and then carving something out of bone. You know, I just, it's really amazing. And I just want to know, what were they listening to? What did they hear?
Can you tell me a little bit? I mean, we haven't still talked about your sort of extended techniques, but I'd really like to hear, since you brought it up, when you're composing, and a lot of this compositional process, I believe, is improvisational. In the
Yeah.
moment, at least. Can you just tell me how it relates to a concept like that? When you're talking about the earth under the sea, and you're reading about Doggerland, and you're imagining if you, Laura Kanell, personally had existed in this time a few millennia ago.
Because it's not that different to walking past the pigs, is it? Not really.
can you tell me, like, how does the interplay between these landscape concepts and this idea of place, and setting yourself in that place, how does that translate into a musical process?
Do you want the really honest answer or the slightly whimsical answer?
Both I figure whimsy is
It
just as honest as fact.
is, it is. It's just more unintentional. All of it's quite unintentional. So I never related what I was doing to the landscape at all. So when I sort of went solo after Horses Brawl, so basically 2012, 2013, I was really spending a lot of time going, who am I? What am I? What can I do? Have I got anything to say? What have I spent the last 15 years doing? I've gone completely mad. You know, those sorts of general questions after, actually, it was like after 10 years of being a professional musician. And I just had to work out what I had to say musically. So to answer the question, I kind of took myself to lots of rural churches that were open dawn till dusk, and I went in with my violin and I just played and played and played and played. And I felt weird and exposed, and there was nobody there, but I felt really, really like, oh, horrible. But I had to find out if I had anything to say on my own, not in a duo or a trio or in an ensemble or any of those things. So I went and did that, and then I released my first album, first solo album, Quick Sparrows Over the Black Earth. And that came out in, I made it in 2013, and it came out in 2014. And that was really the beginning of kind of everything that I do now. But I didn't think about the landscape at all. I just made some stuff. I improvised. I know I didn't just make some stuff, but what I realized is that everything that had gone in to my fingers and my head and my ears and my instruments, I must have something to say. And what I'd put in was loads of medieval, Renaissance, Baroque music and experimental music. So that was like my, that were, they were all my sources. And also, like, so that's kind of what started to pour out, I suppose. And I just really, I never really got on that well with really traditional music from East Anglia, because it wasn't something that, it was like male singing, really, sea shanties, melodeons and hammered dulcimers, and I just didn't, it didn't, you know, the traditional tunes didn't really, yeah, they didn't really inspire me, and I felt like they, it wasn't my voice at all. It wasn't the voice of a woman or a different instrument or the time or place that I'm in. And so I wanted to create, I think I just basically wanted to create my, I wanted to allow myself to say that my folk music is the music that makes up me, and my traditions are what I, are everything that's gone into me. And so it's like just thinking about us as our own, we are our own like worlds and universes, and everybody's got all these different experiences. And so that kind of empowered me, just being able to think like that, that I do have something to say.
But it's really interesting to be able to say that, and to say, I am this tradition, and if it differs from that which, someone at Cecil Sharp House would say is East Anglian music.
That's a you problem, not a me problem. No, but that's
Exactly.
the thing, it's like I just can't fit into what anything that gets too serious or traditional or has rules or right and wrong answers. I'm just like, no, this isn't right. This isn't how it's supposed to be. It's like with folklore, it's like there isn't one definitive thing. It's what we need is what the thing is at the time. You know, what you need to get from a story and what you need to hear and how you need to hear it. There's no point in making somebody listen to the same story in the wrong, see, I'm saying wrong, but in a way which doesn't relate to them. It has to relate. You have to make it relatable. And so it's like with the music, for me to make the most magical thing, because my whole thing for myself, what I tell myself is always choose the most magical. And that's taken me a really long time. And it does sound quite whimsical, but it is, isn't it? Always choose the most magical. Anything. It can be like, you know, you're in the supermarket and you're like, I want this one, but this one's 5p more or less. Which one makes you feel nice? Get the one that makes you feel nice if it's not a huge difference, you know? Like, what's the point? All we trade in is feelings. That's everything is feelings, isn't it?
Towards this personal folk music, shall we say, you began using some of these techniques, overbowing, for example. I
Yeah,
don't even
so
know if that's your phrase or if that's something
yeah, that's
other people
completely
say.
made up.
Okay.
So when I played, yeah, so part of what I wanted to do was, when I was doing my solo stuff, was be able to do the most that I can on my own without plugging anything in. I mean, that's changed a bit now because I quite like plugging things in. But I wanted to see how what I can do, what's the most I can do as one person to feel like I'm filling the room and I'm expressing as much as I can, or you know, as little, but to have like a broad range. And so I started playing two records at the same time, calling it double recorders. But there is an instrument which is fixed, but I'm just using two recorders at the same time. But this is from a piece where I learned to do that was from a piece by Louis Andriessen, who's a minimalist composer from Holland. And he wrote it, I think, in 1981, a piece called End, ENDE. And it's for two recorders and one player. And it's like everything is in contrary motion. So it's almost like playing the piano. You've got a right hand and a left hand, and on the score, it's got a right hand and a left hand. And but I mean, it took ages to learn. It was really hard, but it was just I spent hours in a basement trying to do this thing and breathing and tonguing into two different instruments. Anyway, that then came back into my mind as like, oh, actually, what would happen if I wasn't playing somebody else's music and I wrote my own music using this? And I was like, wow, this is cool. And it turns out to be like a very medieval technique. And actually, the aulos is an ancient Greek instrument, which is a double reeded thing. And there's loads of stone carvings and ancient sort of paintings and things like that of this instrument. So it's actually not contemporary, but people don't really do it that often. So it feels very contemporary.
Right,
So
yeah.
there's that technique, which is ancient but modern. And then the other thing that I do is something I saw in a workshop when I was about 18. So just learning the fiddle, it was at a fiddle workshop led by Liza Carthy, and it was overbowed. See, that's a complete, I've made this word up, but basically it's taking your bow apart. So the way that the violin bow is made is it has a pin in one end, and you unscrew the pin and it detaches the hair bit from the stick. And that is the technical name for the stick. Okay, so then you can pull those apart. So you've just got this kind of dangly, it looks kind of like a fishing line. And then turn it upside down and put the stick part underneath the violin. And I'm doing lots of arm gestures because I'm trying to describe it. And then you put the hair, the horse hair, over the top. And then you hold the stick and the hair together. And then you can pull it across and you're basically making like a hurdy-gurdy, which is ancient wheel fiddle, which is the same
Yeah.
thing, except that instead of having a bow, you've got a wheel that makes the sound. And they used to be called, well, they're called wheel fiddles. But yeah, so I can play two, three, and four strings on the violin at the same time, which means I can do chords and I can just do this sort of very ancient sounding magical thing.
So in other words, you're playing you're turning the bow into something that's a bit more like a saw or something.
Yeah, and you do, it's like getting it to flow and all those kind of things because you've only got a very short amount of bow that you can actually use.
Yeah.
So it's all about the kind of speed that, I mean, violin playing is all about the speed of the bow as anyway, but you've got more sound and less bow. So really, I just love it. It's like breathing and plate spinning. It's kind of like you're dragging this thing, but it's also like you're keeping the sound going all the time, like you would if you were spinning a plate. So in my
Yeah.
mind, I'm like, quite often I'll stop playing a note, but the sound is still going in my head.
Right.
So it's like just sort of letting it breathe and letting
Letting that
it sort of
happen.
carry on. I've been doing some writing for library albums, which is a you know for TV and film, and one of the things that's really brilliant about that is that you can kind of I can experiment. I use it as a money earning experiment, which is like quite weird because in a weird way I'm letting myself go more doing that and just trying out new things. So I'm writing like loads of string stuff and like loads of more kind of drony stuff, some electronic stuff, you know, like sort of dancey, weird. Oh, just I'm just seeing what's in there, you know.
That's so cool. And but you can't put that out under your name, can you?
No, it's out under my pseudonym, which is Isabel Raven. So it is like on Spotify and all those places as well. And then it gets used in weird programs that I find out like 6 months later.
Right. Like what? Can you tell me what?
like some really weird ones. Gardener's World.
Nice.
That's not that weird. That you could see my music works in there. The great. What's the thing called the Great Race Across the World or something like that? Race across the
Oh,
something.
right. No, I don't know. That's
What
great,
else?
though.
Oh, I know a good one. What We Do in the Shadows, which is like that vampire thing on BBC
Yeah,
Two.
that's
Yeah,
brilliant.
very cool.
Yeah.
They used a really funny Crumhorn piece that I
Oh, that's
did.
so
So
great.
yeah, loads of stuff. Some weird Netflix ones, Sky TV, films all over
Lovely.
the world.
I
Just
didn't
like,
know you did that.
no,
But that's
I probably should
so.
tell people.
What's
I
that?
probably should tell people. And I used to be a bit more like, oh, I feel a bit weird about, signing away the rights to this music that I've made. And then I'm just like, there's always more music. Just make some more music. It's fine. You can't live like this album is the album, and that's all the stuff I've got, and I'm putting it all in here, and for 5 years I can't think about anything else or do anything else, and everything's important on there. I just think I can't live like that.
You said that when you began doing this stuff, landscape wasn't a part of it.
Okay, yeah.
Even if you don't do it on purpose, that's not the case now.
No, absolutely. It's there. And I think that when I put out the Quick Sparrows Over the Black Earth and started getting reviews, and people were describing it in such a way that was so related to the landscape, that I hadn't, it's exactly what I was in, and I just never knew that you could hear it in the music. And I was in this kind of cold, barren, needed something to come out of nothing. But obviously, there's always, it's never nothing, is it? It's like when trees are, haven't got any leaves on, there's so much going on. There's never nothing. So I kind of like drawing things out of the walls of a church, and drawing things out of the landscape. But I don't name things till afterwards. So I just write music and I record everything, and then I might like transcribe it and learn it. If I've written something that I really like and I'm just like, oh, I don't know how that happened, then I have to like work it out and then learn it so I can go and play it on tour or whatever. But I really love improvising, and it's like the more you improvise, the more better. Obviously, you get at finding your way of doing it. And I just, sometimes I'll just stare out of a window, and I made an entire album, These Feral Lands, Volume One, which had the, it's just got the comedian Stuart Lee on it doing singing and writing. That whole album was based on being really sort of frustrated and not really knowing what I wanted to do, like musically, just feeling a bit like, oh. So I just got my violin and I stood in my house and I stared out the window, and then there was a buzzard on a telegraph pole, and I could, it was like just across, we used to live on the edge of a farmyard, and so it was one that used to visit all the time, and I just sort of stood there and I looked out the window, and I just put my Zoom recording thing on in the living room, and I just stood there and played and played and played, and just sort of not thinking at all. And then I came back to it, and then I just chopped it up into little sections, and I was like, and I called them all Buzzard One, Buzzard Two, Buzzard Three, Buzzard Four, you know, and I sent those over to Stuart, and but I renamed them just Track One, whatever. And then he wrote some of his words and stuff over these things, you know, sent me his response, and then I made it into These Feral Lands, Volume One. So I've got a new project which is starting, well, starts now, January 2024, and is going all through the year. It's basically a series of monthly releases, which I did a couple of years ago. I did like a monthly kind of sound diary. This one is kind of, it's solo and it's based on lore, so L-O-R-E, and each month is a different lore, completely made up relationship in there. So the first month is sea lore, and then we've got earth lore, bird lore, plant lore, all those kinds of things. And it's because I'm just really, I didn't really want to put an album out at the moment, but I've got this music that I've been working on, and a lot of it's to do with the Doggerland stuff that we've been talking about. But I just didn't, I don't know, it didn't sit well as a whole thing. And I just, my attention span is like, I just like little things quite often. And I just felt like, do I want to sit and listen to an album at the moment? And I just felt like there's just too much stuff going on everywhere in the world and in my head. And I just thought, actually, do you know what? I'm just going to make a series. So I'm just going to put it out as a series because that's what I want to do. And hopefully some people will come along the journey and it'll be like a limited edition CD, but mainly, and digital, but mainly just sort of really leaning into the folklore stuff, I suppose, but also in a way where I'm not doing any research particularly, apart from, I mean, I don't th no, but I don't think I'm like a researcher. I go off on things and then I throw it all away and do what I want.
Yeah,
I mean, that is research.
absolutely. No, you're well, but like you said, all of these things, it all, like when you're
It all
talking
goes
about
in.
always choose the most magical thing. I
Yeah.
mean, that's an antique dealer's daughter, if I ever heard
Yeah,
one,
I
right?
suppose so, yeah.
All of this stuff feeds
Yeah.
in, doesn't it? And then your
Yeah.
job is to be the vessel through which
To
it comes
turn it
out
into
again.
something. Yeah, absolutely. I suppose that's the thing. It's like actually trying to describe it and explain it is like ultimately the best thing is just not talking and doing it.
Thank you for listening to Uncanny Landscapes. We'll be back soon with the next installment. My guest has been the musician Laura Cannell. For more about Laura, visit her website at lauracannell.com. That's Laura, CANNELL.com. The music has been fragments from Laura's recently released Lore series, Earth Lore, River Lore, and Sea Lore. They're all available from the Brawl Records Bandcamp site. That's BRAWL Records.bandcamp.com. The Uncanny Landscapes title theme is by the Bellbury Polly, and the icon is by Stefan Musgrove. I'm Justin Hopper. Follow me on Instagram at Old Weird Albion, and subscribe to this podcast's free cousin Substack, helpfully also called uncannylandscapes.substack.com. Finally, all the links I've just mentioned are on the Substack or the Uncanny Landscapes anchor page, which is uncannylandscapes.podbean.com, where you can also find all the previous episodes. More installments coming soon, including interviews with artist Tony Haywood, hauntologist Drew Mulholland, artists from the Cafe Otto and Soundfjord Encounters series, and more. If you've enjoyed this and other episodes, please subscribe to the Substack and like, rate, or share the podcast, or just tell a like-minded friend or two.